Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is HBC News.
Philosophy and pop culture.
A right-to-die debate is heating up in Colorado, where Kenny McCormick's feeding tube has been removed by his BFF.
South Park is one of the shows that takes on sacred cows and kicks the hell out of them.
I'm going to get that feeding tube removed if I have to go all the way to the Supreme Court.
Cartman!
Kenny's BFF says that Kenny didn't want to be kept alive artificially. The courts have determined we must obey his wish.
Popular culture is something that people are already interested in, so you don't have to get them interested in that.
Our guest is Richard Hanley from the University of Delaware.
It's mostly a sneak attack. I don't really care underneath how well the pop culture itself presents the issues. I'm more interested in the truth.
What truth?
There is no spoon.
Is Kenny today's Christ figure?
Philosophy and pop culture. Coming up on Philosophy Talk, after the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Barry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today, Philosophy Talk is on the road. We're recording the program in front of a live audience in the Gore Recital Hall at the University of Delaware's Roselle Center for the Arts.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Yes, we're on the road again, but wherever we record the program, our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Our topic today is philosophy and pop culture.
Hey, Ken, isn't that a bit of an oxymoron? Philosophy is high culture, about as high culture as you can get.
But, John, philosophy is making real inroads into pop culture. There's a whole series of books on philosophy and pop culture covering topics like hip-hop and philosophy, Star Trek and philosophy, Monty Python and philosophy, the Atkins diet and philosophy, even South Park and philosophy.
Come on, isn't that just a clever scheme to make money off the intellectual cachet of philosophy and the thousands of people that are listening to Philosophy Talk and getting interested in philosophy? Can pop culture actually teach us anything about philosophy? For that matter, could philosophy teach us anything about pop culture?
John, you know, philosophy is the new cool, man. Seriously, lots of important philosophical ideas get played out in pop culture. There are lots of movies and TV shows that explore the paradoxes of time travel, or puzzles about personal identity, or the nature of right and wrong. Take the Matrix movies, for example. At the core of those movies, there's a really famous philosophical thought experiment.
That would be the problem of the brain in the vat. How do you know that you aren't a brain suspended in a vat full of liquid in a laboratory and wired to a computer that's feeding you your current experiences? How do you know you're not? Hundreds of amazingly dull and detailed articles have been written in the philosophy journals about just that question.
Yeah, and this movie is really about that question. But, you know, it's not just these puzzles and paradoxes. It's also the philosophical attitude that's made its way into popular culture. I mean, we like to say that our program, for example, is the program that questions everything
except your intelligence.
But there's a TV show that embodies the same questioning spirit. Guess what it is?
Probably The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. His skeptical, questioning attitude enables him to see through intellectual fraud and pretense.
Well, that's a good guess, but I was actually thinking of a show that's a little less highbrow than The Daily Show, with a much harder edge and is done in, well, frankly, quite poor taste.
Poorer taste than The Daily Show? Now, what could that be?
Well, that would be South Park. Stan, Cartman, Kyle, and Kenny jointly embody, they embody a deeply philosophical spirit. I mean, they're the kind of guys who aren't afraid to label BS, BS when they see it, no matter who they have to offend in so doing, no matter how uncomfortable it makes us to listen or watch. That's the very soul of philosophy, man. Refusing to be taken in by fraud and pretense, refusing to comfort even the tormented and the afflicted.
Good Lord, Ken. South Park is philosophy? They not only question BS, they pick it up in their hands and throw it at each other. Do you really believe that's where the future of philosophy lies?
Well, Well, I don't know. I can't say I'm a real big fan of South Park, but our guest, Richard Hanley, is. I mean, he's an expert on philosophy and pop culture in general, and philosophy and South Park in particular. I mean, he actually founded the discipline of philosophy and pop culture, I think you could say. He'll be joining us in a little bit.
Wow, a discipline founder joining us. That's thrilling. I'm going to ask him, what's going on here? Is it really philosophy going to benefit from popular culture, or is he just trying to make a quick buck?
And in our second segment, we'll take a less cynical turn and dig into some examples of philosophical ideas and attitudes showing up in pop culture, from South Park to The Matrix, from Monty Python to Lord of the Rings.
And after that, we will look closely at an age-old area of pop culture's engagement with philosophy, namely the puzzles and paradoxes of time travel. How has philosophy dealt with them, and how have they been dealt with in science fiction?
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Cornelli, looks at philosophy in other pop culture quarters. She files this report.
Steve Gimbel is a professor of philosophy at Gettysburg College. But before he embarked on that career, he spent several years doing what many misfit youth before him had done. He followed the Grateful Dead.
It really was a laboratory for social experimentation, alternative ways of living, and no matter how weird you were, there was somebody who was weirder.
Chuckin', got my chips cashed in, keep truckin'.
Gimbel didn't abandon his rebellious spirit when he got tenure. He's the author of The Grateful Dead and Philosophy, Getting High-Minded About Love and Hate. That's hate like the street in San Francisco. The book manages to attach philosophy to various aspects of the Dead's lyrics and lifestyle. One chapter looks at the song Lady with a Fan.
Eyes alight with glowing hair, all the fancy paint says fair. She takes her fan and throws in the lion's den.
In the story, you've got a storyteller who tells the story of a beautiful woman with a fan that gets thrown into a lion's den. And she challenges two men, whoever comes out with the fan, I will marry. And one realizes this is dangerous, I could really get hurt, this is stupid, and opts against. The other embraces the danger, comes out, and ends up with the woman. And the question then, the storyteller, as the song goes, makes no choice. You decide who was wise.
That's how it stands today. You decide he was wise.
That question, then, is, you know, it clearly is a larger allegory for how to live. And you get these concerns about how it is that we go about making our choices on a day-to-day basis.
At times, it seems like the authors are using the Grateful Dead as a vehicle or even an excuse to talk about philosophical concepts that already exist. But Gimbel insists there's something philosophical about the very essence of the Dead. He says whenever norms are being challenged, there's philosophy to be done.
Philosophy really is sort of the CSI of the intellectual world. It's not until everything is suddenly burned down, until there's a body, suddenly it's like, uh-oh, get the philosophers. What just happened?
And now for something completely different.
Another book in the same vein is Monty Python and Philosophy, Nudge, Nudge, Think, Think. Gary Hardcastle from Bloomsburg University co-edited that volume. He says not all pop culture lends itself to philosophical analysis.
But with Monty Python, you know, it's just an afternoon's work with a cup of coffee, and it all falls out pretty quickly.
He says that's because a lot of Monty Python's comedy overtly deals with problems that analytic philosophers struggle with.
There's a skit where Michael Palin plays a hijacker in a plane. And you see the cockpit in the plane, and in comes from the back Michael Palin. And what he says is,
"All right, don't anybody move."
But right away, he and all the people in the cockpit, they all question whether or not that's possible. In fact, they all together begin to talk about, well, you know, what counts as movement exactly?
I mean, one couldn't, for example, stop one's insides from moving.
No, right? Good point.
I mean, the very fact that the plane is continuously vibrating means that we're all moving to a certain extent.
And we're all moving our lips, aren't we?
Yes, absolutely.
And the whole skit is an analysis of the word move, what it means to move, in such a way that nobody moves is true, and yet, of course, you know, other things happen. And it is very much, I mean, if you open up Wittgenstein or a number of philosophers, particularly from ordinary language philosophy, what they're doing looks a lot like the Monty Python skit.
Hardcastle says looking for those kinds of connections is valuable.
I think there's a fair amount of popular culture and philosophy work which really reminds us that the questions that philosophers are concerned about have their roots in everyday life. And of course, everyday life is what popular culture is about and reflects back to us.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Roselle Center for the Arts at the University of Delaware. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. And we're joined now by Richard Hanley. He's a professor of philosophy here at the University of Delaware. He's written books and articles on Star Trek, The Matrix, and the movie Memento. His most recent contribution to this fast-growing genre is South Park and Philosophy, Bigger, Longer, and More Penetrating. Richard, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, guys. Great to be here.
So, Richard, I want to start with a somewhat personal question. You study with some of the high priests of analytic philosophy, including me, yours truly here. How did you get from that training into writing about philosophy and South Park and The Matrix and all that? That's not what we taught you back at the University of Maryland, dude.
Actually, it was at the University of Maryland that this all got started. I was lecturing one day, and I was giving an account of the split brain phenomena, that when I was a student, I first heard this, and it just blew my mind. And I looked across the rows of student faces, and I could see people, you know, thinking about what they were going to have for lunch and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, where do we lose kids? And another graduate student and myself, we started to experiment with things. So we went into a middle school and did some teaching of some basic philosophical stuff with kids who are around 10, 12 years old. And giving relatively similar material, you see that aha in their eyes, this sort of spark of recognition and thinking, hey, wow, maybe there's more to this world than I've been imagining. So I started to think about ways of trying to present philosophical material in a way that might actually interest the general public. That's how I got started.
So let me just try to get my head a little bit more around this phenomenon, these books, South Park and Philosophy and all these other books. What's going on here? Are you trying to say that there are ideas in popular culture that need to be appreciated by philosophers? Or are you trying to say that philosophers have ideas that people who like South Park and other parts of popular culture would also like? Or are you just trying to make a buck?
Yeah, what is it here?
I could just say yes, but I should probably expand.
Yeah, you should.
It's mostly a sneak attack, to be honest. That's popular culture is something that people are already interested in, so you don't have to get them interested in that. If you can then use that popular culture thing as a, you know, and as I say, mount a sneak attack, show them that there's actually some interesting philosophical stuff underneath here, and that the ordinary person just on an afternoon by themselves probably doesn't have the training to figure it all out themselves, then, you know, there's room for a philosopher
but
to come in here.
Here's a question for you. Are the ideas in the popular culture already because the creators of the popular culture self-consciously put philosophical ideas there? Or is it just you can philosophize about anything and you use this as an excuse, as it were, to philosophize and you kind of find them there, whether maybe they weren't self-consciously put there? Which is it?
It's a bit of both for me. I'm not that interested in philosophizing about popular culture that is not very philosophical already. So I think that self-consciously or not, some fiction and other pop culture producers do have philosophical ideas and meaty ones underneath.
Isn't there a little danger of overanalysis here? In one of the articles in your anthology, we are told that Cartman is the id, Kyle is the superego, Stan is the ego, and Kenny represents the death wish, bringing Heidegger into the formula. Isn't this just a little bit overdone?
Let me just say yes.
But you don't apologize for that.
I don't apologize for that. I didn't write it. And my own approach to this, and I think there's room for different approaches here, and so I've got no objection to somebody else doing that. But my own approach is just to be a good, hard-headed analytic philosopher, and I don't really care underneath how well the pop culture itself presents the issues. More interested in the truth.
But I do think there is some pop culture that really is self-consciously philosophical. Those Matrix movies, that's self-consciously philosophical. This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Roselle Center for the Arts at the University of Delaware. We're talking about philosophy and pop culture with our guest, Richard Hanley.
We've been discussing in a general way whether you can learn anything deep or philosophically interesting from popular culture. In our next segment, we'll dig into some particular examples. We'd like to have input from our live audience here. Step right up to the mics that are on either side of the auditorium and get ready to share with us your thoughts about philosophy and popular culture.
Philosophy and pop culture from Socrates to South Park, plus questions and comments from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Popular culture really spell the end of civilization as we know it? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, and we're talking about popular culture. Our guest is Richard Hanley, author of Philosophy and South Park, Bigger, Longer, and More Penetrating.
We're in the Gore Recital Hall at the University of Delaware's Center for the Arts. We're in front of a live audience. Are Stan, Cartman, Kyle, and Kenny really the Socrates of our time? Is watching Monty Python really the best way to learn about existentialism or the errors of ordinary language philosophy? Can Star Trek teach us deep truths about metaphysics? We'd love to know what the members of our live audience think. Step up to one of the microphones on either side of the recital hall and we'll open up a bit.
Richard, I want to start this segment by asking you, give me an example, an outstanding example of a philosophically interesting bit of popular culture you've come across.
Okay, I'll start with one that's pretty recent. You mentioned Memento before. The director of Memento, Christopher Nolan, recently made a movie called The Prestige, which if you haven't seen, you should see. It's a fantastic movie.
And, I don't know this movie, so give me a quick
clip. Well, what happens in The Prestige is that unbeknown to you and sort of till partway into the movie, it turns out they have access to a replicator, and they use this replicator to perform particular magic tricks. The transported man. And we find out at the end that interesting things have happened to the products of these replications.
Like what are some interesting things that have happened to the... Like, tell me.
They're all dead.
Oh, goodness.
Well, sorry, spoiler alert.
Yeah, well...
I was trying to avoid that.
Well, but we've got to do the philosophy. So what's the philosophical question this raises for you?
Well, one question is, when you are replicated and what happens is that the original person is kept in the vat of water and drowns, and then the replica walks out, and this raises the issue about what matters in personal survival, whether you can survive such replication.
There's a Star Trek The Next Generation episode that raises similar kinds of worry. There's an episode in which Riker, long time ago, was beamed down to a planet.
Right, 8 years previously.
Right,
yeah.
And then he was beamed back up. But through some transporter malfunction, another one was left on the planet. 8 years later, they come across this planet, and there's Riker down there. But there's Riker also on the ship. Which one is Riker? Right? It looks like they both have equal claim to be Riker.
Indeed. But, and they end up sharing his stuff.
Yeah. So.
Stuff borrowed straight from David Wiggins and Sidney Shoemaker, but actually goes back to Anthony Collins Samuel Clarke in the 18th century,
right.
Just in case people were getting too interested.
Terrific. And there's also a later Star Trek episode where they do a fusion in the transporter as well, where two people are combined in the transporter into one.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say, but Richard, I mean, these are kind of metaphysical, and we're going to get in a while into time travel. Before we get too metaphysical, let me ask you about the political. I've seen criticisms on the net of your take on South Park, because you have kind of liberal take. You think these guys are making fun of right-wing Christians and all kinds of anti-Semites. And there's a whole body of people that think you're missing the point that South Park is libertarian screed. What do you say about that?
I mean, is there a fact of the matter about this?
Well, it's a good question whether there's a fact of the matter. My view is that some people have taken an altogether too proprietary interest in South Park and regard it as, you know, their kind of manifesto. And if it really were, then I should be very uncomfortable watching the show. And yet I, as a card-carrying liberal, can enjoy it, and I think it's much more middle of the road.
Now, let's slow down a little bit. I mean, we're in front of students, mostly, who probably know a lot about South Park, I would guess. But our average NPR listener may not be such a big South Park fan. I'm not sure. So tell me some basic premises of South Park that make some people think maybe they're libertarian, other people think, like you, they're liberal. I mean, what's...
Give us an episode synopsis that could bear either interpretation.
That could bear either interpretation.
Well, give us one that could bear one interpretation.
Yes. Okay, well, here's one. There's an episode called Up the Down Steroid.
Oh, yeah.
And in Up the Down Steroid, they take a completely conformist attitude to the use of drugs in sports, which is surely anti-libertarian. And yet libertarians don't even seem to have noticed this episode.
This is also the episode in which Cartman tries to pretend to be disabled to compete in the Special Olympics, right? And he trains for a week or something really hard to try and be fake being disabled. And he enters the Special Olympics and he loses
because
he
doesn't everything.
He doesn't train to be like a racer or anything, right?
But he gets the Spirit Award.
Yeah. Now, you think there's some deep philosophical point to this?
Of him getting the Spirit Award?
Or either, of the steroid thing?
Yeah. I mean, as somebody who's interested in the political system that we occupy, I think that most of our attitudes to drugs are just irrational. And I
agree with that. South Park demonstrates that irrationality?
I think it does very well when it comes to regular drugs, but badly in the case of drugs and sports. That's my view.
But a lot of South Park episodes do kind of skewer liberalism
sure,
and liberals
sure.
like Gore. And
some
people.
Liberals ought to be skewered. I mean,
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about philosophy and popular culture with our guest, Richard Hanley. And we've got questions and comments from our live audience on this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Tell us your name and then tell us your comment or question.
Sure. My name is Michael. I'm a genetics philosophy double major here at the University of Delaware. Just have a question for Professor Hanley. I think that South Park, in particular, does skewer both the right and the left. Recently, there was, and then other cultural things, pop culture onto itself, like internet memes. There's that whole episode where they make fun of all the things that wind up being popular. But my question for you is, I've always felt that South Park, for me at least, doesn't really take a stand on anything. And maybe that's it shouldn't. You know, it's a cartoon. You know, it's not meant to have any deep statements or anything like that, perhaps, but because it doesn't take a stand on anything, because it skewers both the right and the left and conservatives and liberals, whether that diminishes any sort of strength that it might otherwise have, where if you can make fun of anything, then what's your commentary mean? What is the purpose of it if everything is up for grabs?
That's a good question. Good question.
That is a good question. And I think that this actually shows just how philosophical the show is, because one of the biggest benefits to a philosophical education is what I call taking out the trash. Right? The questions that we deal with are very, very difficult. But most of the answers that people accept ordinarily are just terrible. And philosophy is pretty good at showing that these sort of knee-jerk responses are just what they are, terrible.
But
South Park is one of the shows that actually does that too. It just takes on sacred cows and kicks the hell out of them.
But I mean, while you're kicking the sacred cows out of the corral, you may push the milk cow out too. I mean, isn't there a danger of nihilism, and isn't that really the message of South Park?
John, you would have called Socrates a nihilist. I mean, as just described, South Park takes a Socratic attitude. Socrates had this bit of irony. I know you probably all know this, but he went to the Oracle of Delphi, and the Oracle said, Socrates, you're the wisest person in Athens. And he thought, how could I be the wisest person in Athens? I don't know anything. All these other people are much wiser, and he went around asking all these people, you're trying to get them to demonstrate their wisdom, and talking to them, he realized they didn't know anything. And he realized that the oracle was telling him he was the wisest man because at least he knew that he didn't know.
That's a very, very expurgated theory of Socrates. Socrates is the one that thought the philosopher went outside the cave and saw things as they really were and had to come back in the cave and tell other people about them.
That's Plato later. But what do you think? Don't you think South Park has a Socratic attitude?
I definitely do, yes. It's and often enough, when they do express an opinion, it's usually at the end of the show with "I learned something today," and it's almost always a middle-of-the-road, commonsensical sort of opinion.
We've got more questions from our live studio audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, my name is Megan, and I'm a student at the University of Delaware. And Professor Hanley, I was wondering about a recent episode of South Park that happens to be one of my favorites. It's one where Britney Spears loses the top of her head. And I personally happen to follow avidly the Spears sisters, and I really enjoy seeing their torture on TV. And I was wondering if I was really supposed to learn something from that episode, because I agreed.
You know, that's a good question, and on balance, there isn't a great deal of deep philosophical learning to be gotten out of an episode like that. What I do like is just what you like about it. Once again, it's just going as far as it's possible to go in showing up the extremes of our behavior, right? So we are ridiculously obsessed with certain people. And even when they get the tops of their heads shot off.
So, these are very troubled sisters, particularly Brittany. You don't see anything wrong with just making unmitigated fun of them?
That's a good question. I think if you make your living out of being a public person, then there are limits to the complaints that you can make about being made a public spectacle of. I don't think it means anything goes. But they're
children. I mean, what, is she 23 years old? Not much older than these young people out
here?
That's
not a child anymore, but, you know, that's a full age majority. But I want to ask you a more general question. So you mentioned in passing the movie Memento. And then this other movie, what was it called?
The Prestige.
The Prestige. Though, I mean, Memento is one of my favorite movies of all time, and I think it's philosophically deep. And the Matrix movies, I don't know if they're philosophically deep, but they have a deep puzzle at the center of them, right? Now, South Park, do you really think there's something philosophically deep? I mean, I do agree with you that there is this attitude, this where do you get off attitude, which is the deeply philosophical attitude. But beyond that, do you think there's much deep to be learned?
Yes, and I think it's, with South Park, and unlike the other movies that we've mentioned, those are interesting for very traditional philosophical reasons, deep metaphysical questions, those kinds of things. But not many popular culture things deal effectively with applied ethics issues. And applied ethics issues are ones that we all care very deeply about. The South Park stuff just does, I think, the best job of any show on television of giving an honest look at some of these issues. And it really smacks you in the face because you realize how everyone else pussyfoots around.
Yeah, yeah. Welcome to Philosophy. We've got another questioner on this side of the auditorium. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, my name's John Reed, and I'm a student here at the University of Delaware. Just take it away from South Park for a little bit. You mentioned earlier in the program how you'd like to go to like a middle school classroom and bolster the number of philosophers. And just to give an autobiographical note, I was just thinking how when I was younger, starting with C.S. Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia, how that first got me thinking about, you know, questions of existence and aging and such, and how, you know, with them being involved in movies and other pop culture, how they have people start to thinking about philosophy, how that could, you know, affect.
You're asking us whether those particular movies?
Well, just how you wanted to increase the number of philosophers. If you think pop culture could be an avenue to do so, how it has, you know, the average person think about intellectual.
Well, I mean, I think there's a good question there in a sense that historically philosophy of religion has always been a part of philosophy. And in a way, a lot of that is popular culture. The Bible is popular culture. C.S. Lewis was definitely connecting with the part. Now, it's not the same skeptical audience that South Park is aimed at, but it's in a way, it's the same premise. What do you think, Richard?
Yes, I would agree with that.
I want to say, I mean, I think, see, we in the academy have a too narrow concept. We have let live a too narrow conception of philosophy. I mean, really, philosophy is about imagining and reimagining possibilities and the foundations of your existence and the foundations of your behavior and all that. And literature does that, and some popular culture, not enough, but some popular culture does that. All kinds of things do that. And I think there's really philosophy wherever there is an imagination at work, open to reimagining things. So philosophy is everywhere. And that's one of the points of this show, is philosophy is everywhere. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about philosophy and pop culture with our guest, Richard Hanley, in front of a live studio audience at the University of Delaware. And we have more questions from that audience now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, my name is Dominic, and I have a question for all three of you. In the first Matrix movie, the main character, Neo, is given the opportunity to take one of two pills. And one pill, he goes to sleep and forgets that he ever learned of this alternate universe or alternate reality. And the other pill, he becomes awakened or enlightened. Which pill would you take?
No. Which pill would you take, Richard? You're an expert guest.
Yeah. I think we're supposed to think, of course, we'd want to be enlightened and learn the truth and live an authentic life. But one of the fun things to discuss is just what would be so wrong about taking the pill that keeps you benighted.
It would be inauthentic. You just answered your question. What's wrong with what's so good about inauthenticity?
Putting it the other way around, what can be good about inauthenticity is that you might be happy and you get what you
wouldn't
want.
Wouldn't that be a false happiness?
Well, it depends. I mean, it kind of depends on what you think the metaphysics underlying things is, right? You might actually think that if you were permanently in a matrix, that in fact your experience is not inauthentic because it's genuine experience of a virtual world.
What do you think, John? Which pill would you take?
I would take the second pill. Why? I don't know. I don't want to live a lie. I mean, ask yourself this question. I think this was Philippa Foot's example. If suppose you wanted to be a scientist, then you really weren't very smart. But your parents were incredibly rich, so they just bought out the biology department of the local university and paid all the professors to just play act as if you were a genius for your whole life. You might be happy your whole life, but I just don't think anybody would choose that. Might be hard to articulate the reasons, but that's what I think.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking pop culture with Richard Hanley in front of a live audience at the Roselle Center for the Arts at the University of Delaware.
We've been examining a range of different philosophical ideas as they're played out in popular culture. In our final segment, we're going to zero in on one, the whole idea of time travel, and look at the different ways it's been handled in different settings, in pop culture, in philosophy, in science fiction, from serious and not so serious authors.
Popular culture, philosophy, and the paradoxes and puzzles of time travel, along with more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Traveling trip through pop culture. Does that sound like fun, or would it be a nightmare? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the University of Delaware talking pop culture with Richard Hanley in front of a live audience. And we've got more questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, my name is Brendan. I'm a philosophy major here at the university. I wanted to know is that there's this trend in South Park where it's grown from, like, you know, four kids at a school, you know, from the episodes as early as Mecha Streisand, and it's grown all the way to encompass, you know, huge social issues and have really, really, you know, large-scale productions such as, you know, Imagination Land series. And I was wondering, do you think that the philosophical issues that you speak of in the show, they come up in these earlier episodes? Because it's very certain that they come up in these later episodes and the entire, you know, social and political scope that they encompass. And just also, what is your favorite episode out of the entire, you know, show so far?
I'll start with the second one first. I think on balance, Best Friends Forever is my favorite episode because it was so timely. You know, almost as soon as Terry Schiavo's feeding tube was removed, the episode was on the air.
Okay, for those who are not in the know, what is this Best Friends Forever about?
Best Friends Forever has Kenny hovering between life and death as a vegetable, a tomato. And there are just some terrific plot points. For instance, God wants Kenny dead, but the Republicans and others are keeping him alive, and mainly because of Cartman. And it's just a terrific twist on the usual.
And this was at the time that the Republicans were insisting that Terry Schiavo be kept alive, right? Okay, and in answer to his other question.
And the other one. That's honestly the kind of, you know, survey of the popular culture item that I'm less interested in from a philosophical perspective. But from the point of view of a fan, I find the early season episodes a little harder to watch than the later stuff. You know, they were just finding their feet.
We've got one more question on this side of the auditorium. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. My name's Emily. I'm also a student at the University of Delaware and a student in Professor Hanley's class. So my question is for you. I've read the South Park book, and I'll say in his defense, it has opened my eyes to philosophy like nothing else has and made me want to go further with it. But my question is about Memento. It's one of my favorite movies, but I always thought it was just like a science fiction action movie about retrograde amnesia. I don't understand what it has to do with philosophy, and I was wondering if you could explain that.
I'll try to do it briefly. That might not be easy, but I started using Memento in my time travel class just to demonstrate what it might be like from a psychological perspective, living life backwards compared with everybody else. So that's my main interest in it. And philosophers worry about persistence through time, and a very common answer to how people persist through time is the psychological view, that by having connections of memory and such like, that's how you persist as a person. And a really problematic psychology like Leonard's in Memento
makes
it difficult.
Leonard is, but it's not just about time travel. I can see how you can get that angle on it. But it's also about personal identity, because Leonard has no long-term memories. Everything is constantly new to him. But he has this trick to try to give himself long-term memories, but it doesn't really work because he doesn't remember writing the stuff down. And there's a theory about what makes a person the same person over time. When are some past experiences count as experiences of this person who is here now? When I can remember having them, right? And if memory is interrupted, the continuity of the self is interrupted. And then there's this whole thing about, you know, the self being constructed because Lenny has this narrative of himself, but it turns out it's a false narrative. Actually, this is one of the deepest movies from a philosophical point of view out there.
So just think about your own case or any of our case. I mean, we obviously have memory for what we're doing and what we've just done and for a while back, and that comes from our own perspective. I mean, we see I see my hands a certain position as I lower them. There's almost a trail, like there would be, of where they have been. But now when I think back to some event yesterday or a couple years ago, I don't remember that from the perspective in which it happened. I might be able to reproduce that, but I remember it kind of, you know, like when I think about my high school graduation, I always see it from up above. If I saw it from the perspective I had, I would see nothing but a sea of black, because I always walked around behind Henry Pangborn, who was a very large kid and came ahead of me alphabetically in high school. So there's this change of memory from the kind of memory that really ensures that you can do complicated actions without getting confused about where your hands and your mouth and your eyes are. And then there's this kind of memory that really binds together our whole life and comes in when people ask us where we grew up and what we do and so forth. And how accurate is that, and how much does it matter? So it really gets into a lot of different issues.
But Richard, you mentioned
my article on Memento is all about.
You mentioned that you use Memento in your time travel courses. Now, time travel is a thing that gets exhibited in lots of science fiction. Sometimes it strikes me they make an utter hash of it, and sometimes it's done brilliantly. I mean, can you give me examples from your vast knowledge of this and what it's done well and what it's done poorly and what distinguishes the being done well from the done poorly?
Sure. Two of the most egregious examples of terrible time travel movies from recently are The Butterfly Effect and A Sound of Thunder, both absolutely awful from a philosophical point of view.
Why? Not very good otherwise. Yeah, why?
They fall for the three-card trick that most of these stories do, which is thinking that time travel would be a means to change your own past, the past of the timeline that you occupy. That's just a mistake.
Now, on the other side of the coin... Your South Park guys have a time travel episode where Cartman wants a Wii.
A Nintendo Wii, yes.
And he's going to freeze himself. And he wakes up 500 years in the future. And then he calls back to try to undo, right? So they make your favorite show makes the same.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, this is incredibly common. I haven't done the numbers, but I'd say if you were looking to genres of science, of time travel fiction where they don't make this kind of mistake, probably romantic fiction is the only one where they don't.
Explain why it's a mistake, though.
How about Terminator 1? Now, that's not exactly romantic fiction, but does it make this mistake?
No. But I'm saying, in terms of genres, that's where they just use time travel as a device for placing someone in the past, and they're not worried about trying to change it. Terminator 1 is consistent, and so that is a good movie from this point of view.
Because although it's an attempt to change the past, in fact, as it turns out, nothing changes.
Let me ask you a question. To explain to our audience why it's a mistake to think that you can use time travel to change the past.
Well, because you can't make an event that happened have never happened. That would be a contradiction.
Well, suppose you believe there are alternative timelines, and an event that happens in one timeline doesn't happen on another timeline, and here you are at this point where the timeline could go to the right or it could go to the left. You go back to the point where instead of going to the right, you make it go to the left, and then nothing on the right line happens.
Well, now, wait a minute. If there are alternative timelines, they're both already there. So what have you changed?
You haven't changed a thing.
Haven't you changed the one in which...
You might move from your native timeline to one in which you're an immigrant, but you haven't changed that timeline either. From your experiential perspective, it might seem to you as if you've changed the past, but you haven't.
But now I want to. Let's take Terminator 1. Is that
I didn't tell you get to tell you about my good ones? But
oh,
we'll
okay.
Get to
no, you tell us about a good ones.
tell us about your good ones.
Is Terminator 1 isn't the top?
Terminator
top
1
of
is
the art?
Good, but again, you have this basic device of people trying to change the past. Oh. My favorite movie in this respect that gets things right is Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
What? So what happens in Bill and Ted's? What happens in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure?
There are plenty of causal loops, all consistent, and at no stage do Bill and Ted ever waste any time thinking, oh, gee, I better go back and change that. All they're thinking is how to use the time machine to bring about
I'm still a little confused. I hate to admit this. I'm still a little confused because if I believe in branching times and not a single timeline, then I grant you that in some sense all the timelines are in some sense all exist in some sense. But there is an episode in Star Trek, The Next Generation, in which they hop from branch to branch to branch to branch to branch.
Right.
How do I understand that? Can I make any sense of that? Of the hopping from branch to branch to branch?
Yeah, I don't think there's any logical inconsistency there. But if you're understanding that as a way of changing the past, that's my objection. It's not a way of changing the past.
Right, because all those pasts are still coexistent in some sense.
Right, and one interesting question is, you said, couldn't you go and change that event on another timeline? Well, you know, that's a deep metaphysical claim that you can change that event on another timeline.
I was trying to make sense.
Is it a distinct event, and why do you care about that one?
A lot of science fiction seems to believe in branching time, mm-hmm. right? And they do have this idea of hopping from branch to branch, and I'm not quite sure how to understand that on your... Right, because change this, somehow the native to that timeline has been pushed over there.
Well, you can understand it if you take the view from nowhere,
right.
And you can decide which of the branches you're going to examine at a given time. But I'm not sure, since the view from nowhere really doesn't make sense if you're talking about the actual world, I'm not sure that makes sense. But you know, we may have lost our audience by now, so Richard, why don't you sum up this whole discussion?
sum up this whole discussion for us. Give us some concluding thoughts.
I was going to give you one more good movie, and that's Harry Potter 3, The Prisoner of Azkaban, which handles causal loops beautifully, shows the same series of events from two different perspectives.
Tell us what a causal loop is.
Fantastically. A causal loop is a chain of events which are causally connected by having normal causation, but also reverse causation, where...
something in the future can affect something in the past.
That's correct.
Right.
And you get a loop when these link up, so that in some sense, every event on the...
So Harry Potter has something else to recommend
event.
It. It handles time travel. Harry Potter 3.
Yes, indeed. I think the movie handles it better than the book.
Ah, there you go. So on that note, Richard, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much. Me too.
Our guest has been Richard Hanley. Professor of Philosophy here at the University of Delaware, author most recently of South Park and Philosophy, Bigger, Longer, and More Penetrating.
We also want to thank our live audience for participating in the program. Give yourselves a big round of applause.
So, John, you started out kind of cynical and skeptical about this philosophy and popular culture. Did Richard Hanley win you over to the cause?
Oh, Richard won me completely over to the cause. What a scintillating, bright, younger type of man. Young man, sort of youngish man,
and
not yet too old a man. I read quite a bit of the South Park book, and it's full of interesting philosophy. I'm still a little skeptical about the style. It seems to me, rather than the sober approach of philosophy affecting the way we think about South Park, the kind of some kind of style that's a mixture of Jerry Fodor and Kyle is taking over philosophy. I'm not sure I'm enthusiastic about that.
You might think that Richard committed the mimetic fallacy or something like that. If you want to talk about something, you have to be like something. So he's got this South Park kind of vibe to his writing.
But who can argue with all these bright, young, scintillating, philosophy-interested University of Delaware students he's recruited by doing this.
Well, there you go. You know, this conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For the final word on pop culture, we turn to the guy on our staff who follows it and exemplifies it most closely, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes. Maybe it all started when comic books went away to be replaced by graphic novels. It was around the time B-action movies got budgets and movie stars and became A-movies, and suddenly folks started taking pop culture seriously. A movie like Iron Man, which would have been made by Lex Barker in a tin suit when I was a kid, today stars Robert Downey Jr., and gets reviews that call it intelligent. I never took movies seriously as a kid. I loved them, but I never talked about them except to relive the cool parts. Today, we only talk about pop culture and its effects on identity issues, gender issues, social behavior, racial issues. There's a line of popular culture and philosophy books published by Open Court that attempt to mine philosophical meaning out of pop culture. Titles include The Doe of Homer and Buffy the Vampire Slayer in philosophy, Fear and Trembling in Sunnydale. Well, okay, if you can find Hegelian echoes in The Simpsons, fine. You'll watch The Simpsons feeling a little bit smarter, and you'll still never actually have to read Hegel, so it's a win-win. But some philosophers think this is a bad trend. It dumbs down philosophy and misrepresents or glosses over complex philosophical positions. There's a fear also that if philosophy becomes too popular, it may lose its rigor. Next thing you know, we'll have Immanuel Kant on ice. We already have the Four Dummies books, and there are thousands of books about gardening, say, or Louisiana cooking, the presence of which have had no notable effect on green thumbs or appetites. Or take the millions of self-help books out there. More coming every day. You think ourselves would have long been helped by now, but no. And I suspect that pop philosophy books will be the same. They'll keep on coming. At the end of the day, we still won't know a damn thing. If philosophy does want to get more popular, though, it's going to have to not just observe, but to inject itself a little more aggressively into pop culture. Why hasn't there been a philosophy professor superhero, for example? Professor Rick Thrombone, say, ethicist by day, crime fighter by night. He is Brain Man. He not only saves the world, at least ontologically, fairly often, but he also provides a postmodern spin on the mind-body problem. Is he Brain Man? Is he Professor Rick Thrombone? Whose mind is minding the store? And there will be a supervillain as well, Dr. Sophistry, Doc Soft to the fans, who relentlessly attempts to tear down the pantheon using philosophical thought experiment zombies, identical to humans in every way. So when Brain Man gets the brain signal from the Authenticity Crisis Center, he springs into action. Well, before he springs into action, first he has to satisfy a deep philosophical question. Is the brain signal really a signal? Isn't it just a signifier that needs to be combined in the brain with the signified? And whose brain? Rick Thrombone's or Brain Man's? Well, once he solves all that, believe you me, evildoers, beware. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2008.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to the Department of Philosophy and the Department of Linguistics and Cognitive Science, and to Dean Tom Apple, all of the University of Delaware. Also thanks to Nick Marks, Dexter Brank, and Steve Litterist. To Merle Kessler, Zoe Corneli, Javed Muhammad, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein is our director of research, and Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and from Powell City of Books. Support also comes from the Templeton Foundation.
And also from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.